Thank you, Bob. All right, so I'm going to be talking about a somewhat related topic. I'm going to be talking about discontinuous shear thickening fluids, and I'll show an example of what I mean by that. So shown up here is a pool. This is a kiddie pool full of cornstarch and water. And this is a video of someone actually running on top of that fluid. You can see in slow motion, they're stepping in the fluid. You can see the surface waves. You see it's shiny. It really looks like a fluid. And it is a suspension of particles in water. But the person is able to walk on top of this fluid, a very unusual property. So cornstarch and water is one example of a discontinuous shear thickening fluid that has these solid-like properties in response to some sort of shear. I'll show you another one right here. This picture on the right, you can see this is a rod that is impacting the same material coming into the screen here. And you can actually see cracks form at the surface. So another solid-like property that appears in this fluid in response to shear. Once you remove the shear or remove the stress, these materials melt back into a liquid. So it's some sort of liquid-solid-like transition that depends on shear, a very unusual type of transition. And the general problem that we want to address is basically, why does this fluid have solid-like properties? What is the physical mechanism that allows this in response to shear? What I'm going to tell you by the end, and particularly talking about this problem, is that the reason this can happen is because we get some sort of transiently jammed structure of the particles spanning from one side of the system to the other. This jammed region behaves like a solid and then can support loads like a solid. It can crack like a solid and so on. So that's what I'm going to tell you by the end. I'm going to hopefully convince you of that. All right, so first I'm going to start with something relatively simple. These are steady-state shear rheology measurements. So this is how we characterize these shear thickening fluids. If you're not familiar with rheology, the idea is we're trying to develop some sort of shear profile between a stationary plate and a moving plate. We do this with a rotation, this rotating tool here. The fluid is in between that tool and a flat surface here. And we simply rotate that tool, measure the torque on that tool, and measure how fast it's rotating. From those parameters and some geometry, we can calculate a viscosity, which is the ratio of the shear stress to the shear rate in the system in the steady state. And I'll mention, because this is an important caveat, that this measurement of viscosity is a global average of the energy dissipation rate in the steady state flow. I mention that caveat because it actually differs from a local stress versus shear rate relationship in these materials, which is somewhat surprising, but an important distinction. Okay, so how do we actually define discontinuous shear thickening? Here are some stress versus shear rate curves. This is a sample of glass spheres 100 micron in diameter suspended in mineral oil. So this is another discontinuous shear thickening fluid. Nothing special here, just more hard particles in a liquid. They're very densely packed, so these packing fractions we're talking about are about 0.5 to 0.6, so very densely packed suspensions. This dashed line here would correspond to a Newtonian fluid where the stress is linear in shear rate. Shear thickening, by definition, is where you have a portion of this curve which increases faster than the linear portion. So that would be shear thickening. The discontinuous part comes in when we increase the packing fraction of this system. You can see increasing packing fractions going from right to left. At higher packing fractions, this slope almost looks vertical here. So the stress increases apparently discontinuously with shear rate. So that's the discontinuous part of the shear thickening. And it turns out that that behavior happens in a particular limit. It's when the packing fraction approaches the jamming transition. It's right in that limit where this slope becomes discontinuous. So that's our first connection to jamming, which Eric talked about and introduced for us a little while ago. That jamming transition, in this case, we can measure with a rheometer by trying to measure the yield stress of the material. So we can measure a zero yield stress in a fluid-like state. We increase the packing fraction till we measure a yield stress, and that identifies our jamming transition mechanically. Okay. So this defines our discontinuous shear thickening. Now, to understand where this comes from, I want to focus on a particular point, which is the scale of the stress that we're measuring. So you notice the shear thickening regime where the stress is increasing faster than linearly with shear rate happens between these two stress scales. and those are roughly independent of packing fraction. So those stress scales will be able to compare to different types of forces in the system to figure out which ones are relevant. So those stress scales at the lower end are tau min, at the upper end are tau max. In particular, I'm going to try and figure out what determines tau max. That's going to help us figure out what causes shear thickening in this case. All right. So this is a key part of the puzzle. And there's a lot of stuff on this slide, but the basic idea is that the rheology we measure looks like solid-solid friction, which is, again, a little bit of a surprise based on previous history in the field. So what I'm plotting here, again, is shear stress versus shear rate. This black curve is similar to one of the ones on the previous slide. That's the shear stress there. And now I'm adding on here a plot of normal stress. So on our rheometer tool, we can measure normal stress as just the normal force pushing up on this tool divided by the cross-sectional area of that tool. That's shown in the red symbols here, and you can see it tracks the shear stress very well. Down at the lower end, we're just running into our resolution limit, so that's why it looks noisy. But in the region we can resolve, the normal stress and shear stress seem to be nearly equal. So if you think back to your freshman physics, you know that sounds like solid friction, right? The shear stress is proportional to the normal stress with some friction coefficient of order 1. That's sort of simplest kind of way we can interpret that behavior. To really confirm that idea, we did something where we changed the measurement just a little bit. We changed the boundary conditions of the system. And what we did is rather than controlling the gap height here and measuring the normal force, we decided to hold the normal force constant on that plate and let the gap adjust to keep that normal force constant. So that's just an alternate operating mode of one of these rheometers. So that experiment is shown up here. So the red line is now that controlled normal stress. And the black symbols are the measured shear stress. So you can see, again, the shear stress and the normal stress track each other fairly well, although with some fluctuations. The ratio between the two seems to be about 1, independent of the shear rate. So that suggests we have sort of a fairly universal constitutive relationship, albeit a very simple one, where the shear stress is proportional to the normal stress. But the surprising thing here is that this is all independent of the shear rate and actually depends on the boundary conditions. So this doesn't look like a normal fluid. Normally in hydrodynamics, you would expect to see a similar stress versus shear rate relationship independent of the geometry or the boundary conditions. Here we're saying the boundary conditions actually change things. We're seeing more a solid frictional type of relationship in the mechanics. Now, to understand this a little more, I want to connect to a few other works. These images here are taken from simulations that were published recently by Cito et al. They basically did molecular dynamics like simulations of these particles in suspension, sheared, same sort of setup. And what's shown here are lines where two particles are in contact. So every line on there represents two particles in contact in the system. At very low shear rates down here, they don't see any particle contacts in their system. But once they increase the shear rate, start getting into the shear thickening regime, they start to see some particle contacts. And you can see these sort of span the system a little bit. It's not completely dense until you get further up into the shear thickening regime, maybe at the upper end here. And here, almost every particle's in contact. This is a very dense structure here. So you can see as the suspension is getting thicker, we're getting more and more particle contacts. So what this suggests is going on is the particles are colliding with each other. They're starting to create structures that span the system. And if you have solid-solid contacts that span from one solid boundary to another solid boundary, that can start to support a load like a solid, leading to that solid frictional relationship that we saw in the stress versus normal stress relationship. How is this visualized? So this is a numerical simulation here. Yeah. This other data is experimental. Yeah. Another thing that connects to this that I want to point out are if we measure stress versus time in one of our steady state experiments, it's not just a constant value. They're actually very large fluctuations. It's a very intermittent system. So you notice the scale on here. This spans more than an order of magnitude. So at constant shear rate, I can see these fluctuations of by maybe a factor of 2 or 3. I can see regions where this is much more steady, and then sudden jumps of over order of magnitude in stress. Very, very noisy system. What we would presume, although this hasn't been directly shown yet, is that these sort of large fluctuations correspond to the formation of these system-spanning force chains and then break up again as the system continues to shear. That picture hasn't been confirmed where we've seen those two together yet, but that's sort of what it's suggesting. Okay. Yeah. What kind of force chains do we have in that case? I don't know because people haven't done the simulations yet for that case, so they've only done it for this sort of case so far. So I.
Because maybe you could explain different behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, based on this picture, we would think that we see system-spanning force chains the whole time, but that hasn't been confirmed yet. In the low shear rate regime, how is the normal stress related to the shear stress? That we don't have a measurement of because we sort of ran into our force resolution limit here. So we don't have a good measurement of that.
Yeah. Why does the lower plot changes in time?
Why does it change in time?
Yeah, what happens?
There's spontaneous fluctuation. So the system is, we're controlling it at a constant shear rate. So these are very large spontaneous fluctuations of the system. And again, presumably, because these force chains are forming and breaking up. Yeah. All right, good. Move on. So these experiments down here, I'll just go back one more time. These lower experiments correspond to the case where we control the thickness or that gap size, whereas the alternate option is controlling the normal stress. Those were these experiments up here. So the difference between those two was just the control method or the boundary conditions, basically.
But if you control the normal stress, you still see the shear.
No, we don't. So this is where we control the normal stress. We see it basically looks like a yield stress fluid. So whether or not we see shear thickening actually depends on the boundary conditions. So it's not a bulk or local relationship between stress and shear rate. It is actually dependent on the boundary conditions, which is somewhat of a surprise. You don't expect that in a normal hydrodynamic type rheology. Good. All right. So I want to sort of go one more step deeper and ask, again, I wanted to address where that stress is coming from in the shear thickening systems. We had that stress scale tau max, which was on the order of hundreds of pascal for those glass beads, maybe thousands of pascal for cornstarch and water. So what I'm showing you here is basically a zoomed in video on the edge of our rheometer. So here's our rotating rheometer plate up here, this black region. This is our stationary bottom surface. This white region is a sample. I've switched the particles again to make them more opaque here. So there are 150 micron zirconium oxide particles suspended in mineral oil. You can actually see this is the size of a particle here, but that's just attached to the plate. We're focused on the edge here, so everything over here is blurry, out of focus. And what you can see as we're shearing, the particles are actually poking out the edge of the surface. So it's flat at rest. When we start shearing, you see the particles poke out again. So I'll let you watch it again after this thing stops. So there it stopped. Now we have a nice flat surface. And then once it started again, the particles poke out. You can see them penetrate that interface. And this is not terribly surprising in the sense that we know that granular materials tend to dilate when you shear them. So if you walk on wet sand at beach, and you can do this experiment right outside here conveniently. You step on that wet sand, and it looks like you have a dry region forming around your foot, right? That's because you're shearing the grains. Their volume is expanding very slightly, maybe by a percent or two. But it's enough to suck that water that was at the surface into the voids that opened up in the interior of the material. So the surface looks dry because the particles are poking out. That's exactly what we're seeing here. We're dilating this granular material as we're shearing it. The particles poke out, the liquid sucks in very slightly. And the consequence of that is very important. And I think this was first pointed out by Mike Cates. If I have a flat or a or at least a liquid air interface that's not affected by those particles, I have a very low stress from surface tension just holding that in place. But if I have very small particles on the order of a few microns pushing through that interface, now I have these very small curvature menisci in between the particles. And the stress from that can be relatively large if I have small particles. So the scale of that stress would be the surface tension divided by the radius of curvature of that meniscus, which, if you imagine, the only scale in this geometry here is the size of the particle. So the radius of curvature is going to scale with the particle size. So I have a stress scale that goes as surface tension over particle size, basically. That's going to be the scale of surface tension pushing in on that boundary. So we can actually test whether that's relevant. So what I've plotted here is that tau max. So that's that maximum stress scale that we reach in a shear thickening system in steady state versus that stress scale I just predicted there, that surface tension over particle size. And this solid line is that prediction. And the points are measurements of tau max for a whole bunch of different suspensions where we see shear thickening. Again, these are all sorts of materials. These are just basically hard particles in different liquids, not strongly interacting in any other way. They all show shear thickening. Cornstarch happens to be right there in the middle, actually. But we have things like glass, we have different plastics and so on, spanning from maybe 100 micron particles, or sorry, 100 nanometer sized particles up to about 100 microns or larger. They scatter around this prediction. Now, this is what I would call a zeroth order prediction. It's not getting things exactly right because there are all sorts of differences between these particles that I haven't taken into account. Particle geometry, surface roughness, friction coefficients, contact angles, all that stuff I've ignored. But in terms of the scale of the stress, we seem to be predicting that within the correct order of magnitude. So that seems to give us some sort of picture of what's going on. So I would summarize what I've said so far. In terms of what causes discontinuous shear thickening. So when we shear this granular material, it dilates. The particles tend to push against all the boundaries of the system. Usually, in most experiments, we have that liquid air interface. That's the sort of the weakest interface that the particles are pushing against. That surface tension at that interface is pushing back on the particles. And because the particles are in contact when they're being sheared, then that force gets transmitted along those solid-solid contacts throughout the system. So you have a solid-like mechanical structure where shear stress is related to normal stress with a proportionality coefficient around 1. And as you shear the system, that's the response you measure. And it just requires dilation to trigger that. So that's where the shear rate dependence comes in. You don't see dilation at the lower shear rates. And again, I'll point out that this behavior is not a bulk property or a local relationship between the shear stress and the shear rate in the sense that it does depend on the boundary conditions. In this case, it depended on the surface tension at the boundary. You could imagine experiments with hard walls or even simulations with periodic boundary conditions where you get a different scaling because the boundary conditions are different. So that's sort of a sort of quick overview of what happens in the steady state rheology of these discontinuous shear thickening fluids. So now I want to move back to the question I posed at the beginning, essentially, how can we explain, you know, this idea of someone walking on top of a fluid or running on top of a fluid? And you might think optimistically that I just explained it, but if we look at what we found, it actually doesn't explain this, which is a little disappointing. But based on that steady state rheology that we found, the amount of stress that these fluids can support was from surface tension was only about a kilopascal or so. Surface tension is not that strong, right? You don't expect that's going to hold up a person's weight, even if I have very small particles deforming the surface. The amount of stress it would take to hold up a person's weight if I were running across a pool of cornstarch and water, or even walking, you would need something well above 10 to the 4 pascal, close to 10 to the 5 pascal on average. That's more than an order of magnitude above what we could predict based on the steady state rheology. So that doesn't explain it, unfortunately. There are a few other models on here. I won't go into them in detail. You might be familiar with sort of Stokesian dynamics model, also known as hydroclusters. This is largely the work of John Brady. That's often related to shear thickening, although that predicts stresses that are even lower than that dilatancy model. So that doesn't explain people running on top of cornstarch and water. Another model you might be familiar with, this was published in Nature just a couple of years ago by Wadekaitis and Jaeger. This is basically an inertial model where the force response comes from just a very high-speed impact where you have to displace the mass when you're at high speed. That requires a significant amount of stress to do that. That's a common type of model in granular systems. This particular one, they showed that it could be a little stronger in these suspensions. That would give you this black line up here, which is getting close to observations of people running on top of cornstarch and water, which are up in these red points. Might even explain things up in this region, but definitely not in this region. We have another problem with that, actually, that for that model to work, because it requires displacement of inertial mass, this tends to work with very large volumes of fluid. Although these observations of people running on top of cornstarch and water, these can happen with relatively small volumes of fluid. So if we actually account for that in those models, the amount of stress they would predict would be actually way down here, so even below the other models. So the point here is that of the models we have, none of them have explained the ability of people to run on top of cornstarch and water. So we need some new model or some variation to do that. So these fluids are not viscoelastic, actually, at least in terms of steady state rheology. Although you can see things that look like elastic responses in terms of you can actually bounce stuff off the surface of this. I'll try to tell you why by the end, if I have time. All right. So I want to tell you about more recent experiments to try and get at this impact response problem. Why is it different from the steady state rheology? So these are experiments done mainly by my postdoc, Shamik Mukhopadhyay, who happens to be on the job market for faculty positions right now. We designed the setup. Basically, we have a suspension of cornstarch and water. We have a cylindrical rod that impacts this suspension at a controlled speed. So we're pushing down into that cornstarch and water suspension. We can measure the force on that impactor. We have some high-speed cameras that are looking at the surface of the suspension in different places. So we're looking at the bottom, we're looking at the side, we're also even looking at the top surface. The reason for that might not be obvious why we look at the surface, but when we looked at the steady-state rheology, we could see dilation at the surface, right? That was key to understanding that behavior. So that's why we want to just look at the surface here rather than looking into the bulk. So this is a video of a two-dimensional version of that experiment. You can see our impactor here is the black block. It's pushing into this suspension. In this case, it's held between a half centimeter thick pair of plexiglass plates. You can see in front of that impactor, you see these cracks appear. These are bright because the system is lit from behind. You can also see very faintly this sort of boundary here. So this is actually what looks like a dilating region in front of, around that impact. Same thing you'd see if you step on the wet sand at the beach. So you can see that this, because there are cracks here, it suggests this is probably a solid-like region in here. Again, and if we connect back to that dilation behavior, we'd expect it to have particle contacts as well. So that's not terribly surprising. But what this sort of experiment led us to suggest is that if we can have a system where these fronts propagate, let's say, to another boundary, let's say they propagate all the way down to this bottom boundary, then I could have a solid-like region that spans between two solids, and that would be able to support a load like a solid. So that's basically what we're trying to explain, right? When this isn't spanning to a boundary, it's not going to be able to provide a very large stress response. So this is an example of the force response we measure in that system. Again, this is the force on that impacting rod as a function of the displacement of that rod into the fluid. And again, I'll remind you, this is moving at constant velocity into the fluid. The surprising thing here is that we measure negligible force until the impactor is about 2 centimeters into the fluid. So the impact occurs at this depth of zero. But there's actually this large delay. The impactor is about 2 centimeters in before we feel any significant force. and then it really shoots up here, and we're getting stresses on the order of hundreds of kilopascal up here. If you remember, this is more than enough to hold up a person's weight, so this will connect to that behavior. So as long as we can explain this, we can potentially explain the ability of people to run on top of the cornstarch and water. And when I mentioned that we don't see any significant forces down here, I'll point out that we do see typical responses you'd expect if you did sort of a quasi-static compression into a granular system. You see a buoyancy force. If you do this very fast, you see an inertial response. Those are still very weak compared to this 100 kilopascal stress, so those effects don't even show up on this scale here. So one question we wanted to ask, remember our hypothesis was that those fronts that we saw in that video would propagate to a solid boundary. And now we saw a delay in the force response. So that would suggest, okay, maybe that delay in the force response is because it takes time for that front to propagate. So to test that idea out, we did these experiments for different fluid heights. So if there's a particular velocity for that front to travel through the system, the time it takes for that to propagate all the way across would be proportional to the height of that system. So we can test that out. That's what this data here is showing you. So we've calculated this front velocity, done the appropriate geometry, and shown that these collapse for different fluid heights ranging from 1.5 to 19.3 centimeters. So that seems to confirm that we have some traveling signal, basically, from the impactor to the bottom of the container. That's what's causing that force response. So once that signal can travel to the bottom, we can see that large force increase. Just to save time, I won't talk about this one. We basically see two force increases, this one and this one. They both correspond to different delay times and different front velocities, but I won't get into that too much. Here, this is a video of what we see on the bottom of our experiment. So this is visualizing the bottom surface directly in front of the impactor. I'm going to play through that one again. The impactor, is the cylindrical part, is this is the diameter right here. You can see after a little bit of time, we see, again, what looks like dilation at the bottom. We see these cracks at the bottom surface. This time it's frontlit, so those cracks are black. Again, pretty consistent with what we've been seeing before. We see dilation at the surface. And I'll show you what happens if we zoom in to this region right here in a similar experiment. If we look very closely, we can see what looks like voids. We can see what looks like voids opening up between particles. You can actually see you're seeing like little shiny spots there. That's where the grains are poking out of the liquid-air interface. You can actually see towards the end that liquid was filling those voids back up again. So their grains are poking out. After some time, the liquid starts filling in, and you see maybe very faintly some air bubbles left over at the end. So this fits with this picture. That when we have this impactor come through, it's forming this localized jammed region that's propagating to the bottom. We're visualizing it down here at the bottom. I'll also mention that we see similar dilation at the top surface, just like that picture I showed you on that very first slide. So if we're seeing things at these surfaces, we also look at the side surfaces, we see no such structures. So it suggests to us that this structure is propagating basically from the point of impact down through the system. Yeah. We don't always see that symmetry. We just happen to get lucky with that on this one. Sometimes we see five cracks. Yeah. All right. Let's see. I'll just mention very quickly that the timing of those events that we saw, so the force increase and the structures at the surface, those timings match up. So it just confirmed that the time where we see basically initial motion at the surface, that's when we start to see force increases in the system. But I'll just skip over that one because I'm running out of time. If we put together this picture of the fronts that we found into a sort of phase diagram, we can delineate some different regions where we see this is a y-axis is impactor depth normalized by fluid height. This x-axis is impactor velocity. And this region up here is where the impactor has pushed in far enough for those fronts to reach the bottom of the container. Notice that this depends on the height of the container because the fronts have to travel a longer distance if it's a deeper container, basically. So this is sort of a solid-like region of the phase diagram. Below that, you still have fronts, but they haven't reached the boundaries yet. So this is a region where that added mass or those inertial effects will apply. I didn't explain them too much, but those are covered in other works. And one important point we notice is that when we measure at what height these fronts reach the bottom of the container, and we extrapolate down to low velocities, we see there's a point here where the impactor would have to actually hit the bottom of the container for the front to reach the bottom. In other words, there's no front anymore. And indeed, when we measure at these lower velocities, we don't see any front. So this seems to be some sort of critical point or a minimum velocity that's required to see those fronts at all. So below this velocity would essentially be the quasi-static regime. Above that, this is where we're seeing these fronts. And at much higher velocities, this would tend to be where you see strong inertial effects in other systems. Now, if I take that phase diagram, that can help me explain our observation of a shear thickening transition in this system, which is really nice. So what I've plotted here on this top plot is the shear stress, or sorry, the normal stress in our impact experiments as a function of impact velocity. And because we had stress varying as we push further into the container, we have to choose a particular depth to measure this at. So we chose a particular depth. In this case, it's this one right here. So that's z over h is about 0.5. And if we take the stress at that particular height and for different impact velocities, we see lower stresses down at these lower impact velocities. We see a pretty sharp jump at higher impact velocities. So that would map out what looks like a discontinuous shear thickening transition. Now, if we look at this critical velocity for that jump, we can go back to our phase diagram and see where that fell. It wasn't the same as the critical point on the phase diagram. And that's because in making this plot, I had to choose a particular depth where I'm measuring the stress. So that was this depth again. So if I look at that depth where we cross the phase boundary between the liquid-like and the solid-like regimes, that happens to be exactly where we see this discontinuous shear thickening transition. So the funny part about this is where this transition happens is going to depend on how far you look at the penetration of the object into the fluid. So if we were to look a little deeper, we'd see the transition at a lower velocity. If we were to look way over here at shallower penetration depths, we'd see the transition at a higher impact velocity. Okay. And I want to sort of end up with sort of explaining people running on top of cornstarch and water. So we actually took videos, like that one I showed you in the very first slide. We took videos with high-speed camera, tracked a person's foot so we could measure their velocity and acceleration over time. If we measure acceleration, we can get an estimate of the force on their foot when they impact that fluid. So very, very rough experiment. This was done out on the lawn, not in the lab. But nonetheless, we were actually able to get some useful data out of this. So this is a plot of the foot position, so someone's foot position versus time. Zero here is the surface of the suspension of cornstarch and water. So you can see initially the foot is coming down as this person steps onto the cornstarch and water. And again, you notice they don't slow down significantly at the point of impact. There's this large delay before they start to slow down. And then suddenly they almost stop here. So very similar to our controlled laboratory experiments, that foot penetrates some distance. In this case, it's about a centimeter. And before they actually really stop hard. And then you can see the position stays steady there for a fraction of a second, only about 0.2 seconds, and then they start to sink again a little bit after that. So what's happening here is that material turns solid as they stepped, but that material doesn't stay solid over time. Remember, that material will melt back into a liquid. So that foot was there long enough that the material started to melt back into a liquid, and the foot started sinking again before they lifted up that foot and took the next step. So you can actually see not only is there a stress requirement that this fluid must must be able to support to hold up a person, but you have to be able to run fast enough that you don't sink in the time between the steps. If you walk too slowly, you'd continue to sink. So we can make a prediction from our observation of those fronts in the controlled laboratory experiment. What would be the stopping distance of someone's foot as a function of impact or velocity? This black line corresponds to the depth at which those fronts would reach the bottom of the container. So that's the first criteria. Now, that's not enough to stop a person's foot because you still have to calculate what the force on that person's foot is. That's what this red line is. And basically, it's a very simple calculation. It's basically the work done by the fluid has to match the initial kinetic energy of the person's foot as they stepped into the fluid. So again, freshman physics problem. So the red line is that prediction here. These two black points are two measurements of someone running across a pool of cornstarch. And you can actually see they're right on. So we think with this information, we have a picture that can explain why, or at least demonstrate that we have some sort of picture partially explains why people can run on top of cornstarch and water. We have this picture of, upon impact, fronts propagate through this region, and behind these fronts, we have this transiently jammed solid-like region. So that picture seems to explain this. What we don't have is a more fundamental picture of why do we have these transiently jammed regions in the first place. So that's sort of an open question still to be explained. And I'll open up for more questions at this point. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have two questions. One, I got confused a little bit because you say that the shear rate affects a rarefaction, an increase in the distance between the particles, but you said that this made them more in contact.
Yeah.
That confused me because, okay, you'll explain.
Yeah.
Just saying, that's one question. The other question is, you showed in the tau that there is a tau max, but it was not really max. So you explained what is the value, but it goes beyond. What is it that makes it even larger?
Okay.
Two questions.
So your first question is about dilatancy. So this is actually, this is a common phenomenon in granular materials, but fairly unintuitive, that if you shear a granular material, you actually push particles together and they can become, at least in a suspension, they start to become in contact, but the granular volume expands a little bit. So it's somewhat counterintuitive, but that's actually a common phenomenon in granular materials. So we didn't have to make that up. At a really fundamental level, I don't know how to, predict that behavior quantitatively, but empirically, it's well known, I would say. Your second question about the tau max. So the maximum, so what we called tau max was the maximum stress in the shear thickening regime. Well, it was the maximum, so the shear thickening regime is only from here to here. In this region, the slope is actually less than linear, so it's no longer shear thickening there. So that's sort of the definition, but that's maybe a subtle point.
It's a larger tau.
Right. So the stress increase beyond here could be from other mechanisms. So we still have, let's say, viscous drag between the particles, and there can still even be inertial effects in some of these systems, depending on which particles we're using and how fast we're shearing. So the stress can still increase beyond there, but it's not necessarily increasing from this mechanism I told you about, so this solid-solid contact. And it's increasing more slowly with shear rate, so that this would actually be shear thinning up in this region rather than shear thickening.
Yeah, so you talked about the observation of a friction coefficient of order 1 as being perfectly ordinary, and it is completely not. If you look at the early work, actually people thought the universal friction coefficient was 1/3 or 1/4, and Belador looked at the model of dilation of sphere packings to show it was 1/3, thereby settling the question for 100 years or so. Of course, it was wrong, but never mind. So if you look at dilation effects, typically in ordered packings, you get 1/3. If you look at amorphous materials, amorphous polymers, the coefficient of friction due to dilatancy is usually 0.1. So 1 is really an incredibly large value and normally can only be seen if there's some significant adhesion going on somewhere in the system. And so the question is whether you can rule if that's going on in these systems or not.
Yeah, so that's a very good point. So I'll direct you to this slide, where when I say order one, I do mean really in an order of magnitude sense. So there is a wide range available there. So on this slide, this line actually is that 0.1 coefficient there. But you can still see scatter around that.
But in your specific data where you were controlling the normal load and measuring the shear force, I thought you were saying you were getting one, not order one.
It's still order one. It's not exactly one. It's this one, this particular case happens to be closer to one than the average.
We usually
can sometimes see more than one, actually, yes.
So is there any evidence that there is adhesion between particles, which is not sort of in this model, but I'm guessing may be very important in their behavior?
In this case, there shouldn't be any adhesion. These are 100 micron diameter glass spheres in water. But keep in mind, there are a lot of variables here which we're not controlling. You know, there's friction between particles. There is that.
How about cornstarch?
That one is actually a pretty good model hard particle. So when I showed you that plot of all the different materials together, cornstarch was actually dead in the middle, or almost dead in the middle. It's right here, not particularly high compared to others. The special thing about cornstarch is it's the cheapest of these materials to get. You can buy it at the grocery store. In terms of the mechanics, it's just another hard particle without strong interactions. And that's true of all of these things, like similar to glass spheres.
It's a very interesting talk. So it looks like you eventually can create a situation that people can actually walk on the water.
Yeah. Yeah, how to do that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's actually very simple. and you can find lots of videos of this on YouTube, similar things. You get, easy way to do it is buy a kiddie pool at a toy store for $20. To do something like this, you'd probably need about 300 pounds of cornstarch. Probably get that online, or if you have a big box store or something, you can get that. To mix it, I use a cement mixer because this stuff is so thick. You try to like mix it with some mechanical stir, you can break steel rods with this stuff just trying to mix it. So a cement mixer is the way to go. You can rent that for a day. Do this as a demo for a class or some outreach event. It's a lot of fun to do. We'll do this on a Saturday afternoon. For that sort of thing.
And yeah. How do you throw it out?
How do you throw it out? Storm drains.
What?
Throw it out in a storm drain. Yeah. Just wash it down with a hose.
Thank you.
Yes. So, Eric, I have to point out that there is a recent literature that arguing against your interpretation.
Okay.
And the interpretation of Mike. As you know, Mike himself does not believe at all now in this boundary effect. And the argument is very simple, and it's dimensional, and it has been shown by Jean-Noël Roux and Anaël Lemaître, just theoretically on dimensional analysis. Dilatancy for a purely granular system gives you a purely Newtonian behavior. Then that was supported very strongly by experiment of Boyer and Poulikin, that actually before your experiment were already doing control pressure, and so on. They exactly supported that.
Yeah.
So all those analyses are strongly supporting that shear thickening is not simply granular physics. And since then, many of us, the data of Sato's that you show are not simple granular system, have argued that you need to go beyond purely hard particles.
Right.
And Sato and both Mike and I have argued that you need to have short-range repulsion between particles.
Yeah.
And that shear thickening is not controlled by boundary, but it is a bulk property.
Okay.
So I have to mention that there is really literature that really argues completely against this picture.
Well, I think there's actually a lot of agreement between our pictures, and there are a lot of points in there, so I hope I can hit them all. So one was sort of the results of Poulikin, and you mentioned they do normal stress controlled experiments.
Right. Fixed back compression experiments, find a purely Newtonian behavior.
Right.
Then
right.
So to surface tension, yeah. To cut off, to sort of viscosity.
Right.
Right.
We agree. So in a normal stress-controlled experiment, we do not see shear thickening. That was this case here. That is a fixed packing fraction.
Yeah. You do see purely even behavior, then it is cut off by some attention because plastic stuff, but it does not create.
Yeah. Well, yes. They may argue that theoretically, but experiments have consistently shown that you do see this geotic behavior.
So in a
controlled normal stress or controlled?
So I think this is, so we've been, A, yeah. We've been told that we need to finish, okay. And B, this is probably not an argument that will, I think this will require more discussion, and I turn it over to the people who have the most to lose or not.
Sure.
So thank you.